It's Thursday, March 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, U.S. voters have all but selected presumptive presidential nominees.
We have to be able to show the rest of the world, you want to step on my toes, we're going to step on two of yours. And this is why I voted for Trump.
Also, President Obama selects a nominee for the Supreme Court. A U.S. college student is sentenced to 15 years hard labor in North Korea. The U.S. Central Bank keeps interest rates the same. And who are the happiest people on earth? The answer might surprise you. That's all coming up on today's International Edition. Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump's big wins in Tuesday's primaries have many looking ahead to a race that likely will center on those two presidential candidates. Trump won three of the primaries outright, including the highly prized state of Florida with 99 delegates. He also took Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina. Ohio Governor John Kasich took the Ohio primary. For the Democrats, Hillary Clinton won Ohio, North Carolina, Florida, and Illinois, and holds a razor-thin lead over Bernie Sanders in Missouri. Clinton looks all but assured of taking her party's nomination, and Trump is confident of winning for the Republicans. But the nation remains divided over the presumptive nominees. VOA correspondent Arup Pandey talked to voters in Florida on the issues driving the campaign and whom they favor going forward.
85-year-old Miami resident Marvin Cooper is not buying into the sentiment that all is well in the American economy. He has seen too many of his fellow seniors struggle to get by.
Things are like so expensive so many times, and you just don't have the money. I'm worried about the economy. I think that's really number one.
The day after the Florida primary, politics dominates the conversation at this senior living community near North Miami Beach. Lifelong Democrat Maria Valente voted for Barack Obama in 2008. The 90-year-old says she switched parties 2 years ago, hoping a Republican could boost U.S. military might.
We have to be able to show the rest of the world, you want to step on my toes, we're going to step on two of yours. And this is why I voted for Trump. And I'm glad he won.
While many Florida voters welcome Donald Trump's primary victory, University of Miami political science professor Joseph Usinski says others will be taking the time before the Republican convention to consider what a Trump nomination could mean for the country.
Voters are going to have time to really think about, you know, do they want Donald Trump to be president? It may very well be the case that if he gets the nomination, he may walk right into the White House. And there are a large contingent of Americans who are very uncomfortable with that right now.
Looking ahead to November, it will likely come down to voter turnout and whether a Trump candidacy or a Clinton candidacy will be able to draw their base of supporters out to the polls.
Trump's controversial comments have not deterred supporter Silvana Busaca.
I have a handicapped young man, and he made fun of a handicapped person. Absolutely. That's why I said this person is a little bit strange, okay? But even so, I still have lots of hope for this person because he's not a politician. He's successful.
That sentiment is not shared by Fort Lauderdale resident Julia Allison, who supports Democrat Hillary Clinton.
He's a big clown, and he's not an intelligent man. And Hillary is brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant. She's proven herself. She's a diplomat. She understands international relations, and she won't make our country look bad.
Voters here in South Florida, as elsewhere in the country, remain deeply divided over who will best lead the United States as the next president. Arup Pandey, VOA News, Miami.
Donald Trump has won primaries in states which have a high percentage of so-called evangelical voters, people who say they believe the Bible and have conservative leanings. He has also won endorsement from Jerry Falwell Jr., the president of Liberty University, a Christian college in Lynchburg, Virginia, and the son of the man who co-founded the Moral Majority in 1979. But what exactly constitutes an evangelical voter, and why does Donald Trump appeal to some of them? For one perspective, I spoke with Professor Darren Guerra of Biola University. I started by asking, what is an evangelical voter?
I think the best definitions are evangelicals who hold to certain theological tenets, such as the authority of Scripture, the atonement of Jesus Christ dying on the cross and rising again, certain theological precepts that guide their living and their practice. And then if you couple that with church attendance and measures of religiosity, I think you have a good grasp of evangelicals. The problem with a lot of polling and exit polls is they simply ask people to self-identify as an evangelical. And in certain parts of the country, that could mean any number of things. And as the exit polls that I've looked at show, it could mean people who rarely attend church at all or share those theological distinctives. So that's where you get a bit of the murkiness of who are we actually talking about here.
Donald Trump has done well in the South. He's won states like Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Mississippi, Tennessee, states that constitute what used to be known as the Bible Belt. Yet he has made it, clear that he is not what you call a Bible thumper. Do you think that matters? Do you think that these voters who are professing that being their religion is one that speaks of loving one's neighbor as oneself and, giving one's life for one's friends, are tying into the anger in the U.S. electorate?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing when I look at the data is when you look at evangelicals, broadly speaking, those who show the most measures of religiosity, such as church attendance, or they say that they're voting for candidates based on religion, Trump actually does worse amongst those. He doesn't win majorities. He doesn't win pluralities. on the first Super Tuesday, Rubio and Cruz did much better against the more religious, quote, evangelicals. This last Super Tuesday, Cruz did better than everyone amongst those evangelicals, winning, I believe it was 56% of the vote amongst people who had a high measure of church attendance. So what you see with Trump is he's winning what I would call nominal evangelicals. He's winning evangelicals who self-identify as such, but they don't show measures of religion being super important in their life, and it doesn't show up in terms of them attending church in any large numbers. So I think you have this division amongst this large grouping of evangelicals.
Now, by contrast, Ted Cruz has made no bones about quoting Scripture during his speeches and during his stumping or his campaigning for votes. And he is the son of an evangelical or a Pentecostal pastor. So do you think Cruz appeals more to people who would fit the more of the textbook definition of evangelicals?
Yeah, I mean, the exit polls I looked at suggest that is the case, that he, even in the first Super Tuesday and this election yesterday, Cruz, if you look at the highest measure of does religion matter to you and your candidate, he's always won that category over Trump.
Trump has received endorsements from people, including Jerry Falwell Jr., who is the son of a very prominent Baptist preacher, the founder of Liberty University. How do you explain that?
I think that's a large part of why kind of the evangelical supporting Trump narrative has legs, is because you have these high-profile endorsements like from a Jerry Falwell. In contrast to Jerry Falwell, you also see high-profile evangelicals such as Russell Moore and Max Lucado kind of denouncing Trump or showing a lack of support for Trump. And I think there's some research by Walter Russell Mead and some others that suggests the Trump phenomenon is largely a Jacksonian phenomenon, that there's these Jacksonian voters that appear in American politics every now and then. And it just so happens that Jacksonian voters, blue-collar, highly nationalistic, despise Wall Street bankers and Washington elites, this type of voter also happens to live largely in the rural South and blue-collar areas in the Midwest, where kind of cultural evangelicalism is common. And so you have, I think, Jacksonians supporting Trump who secondarily might also self-profess as evangelicals.
That's Professor Daniel Guerra of Biola University. He spoke to us from La Mirada, California. Coming up, President Obama nominates a candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U.S. President Barack Obama has nominated Federal Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland to fill the Supreme Court seat left vacant last month following the sudden death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia. The president made the announcement Wednesday at a White House ceremony.
I've selected a nominee who is widely recognized not only as one of America's sharpest legal minds, but someone who brings to his work a spirit of decency, modesty, integrity, even-handedness, and excellence. These qualities and his long commitment to public service have earned him the respect and admiration of leaders from both sides of the aisle. He will ultimately bring that same character to bear on the Supreme Court.
The president praised Garland as someone who will uphold the rule of law and the U.S. Constitution.
Judge Garland has brought his trademark diligence, compassion, and unwavering regard for the rule of law to his work. On a circuit court known for strong-minded judges on both ends of the spectrum, Judge Garland has earned a track record of building consensus as a thoughtful, fair-minded judge who follows the law.
Garland, like the president, a graduate of Harvard Law School, called the nomination the greatest honor of my life, besides his marriage to his wife Lynn and the births of their daughters Jessie and Becky. He pledged to be faithful to the Constitution and to uphold the best principles of American democracy.
People must be confident that a judge's decisions are determined by the law and only the law. For a judge to be worthy of such trust, he or she must be faithful to the Constitution and to the statutes passed by the Congress. He or she must put aside his personal views or preferences and follow the law, not make it.
However, a political storm was building just down the street at the U.S. Capitol, where the Republican-controlled Senate has insisted it will not meet with or hold a vote on Obama's nominee to the High Court. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the Senate will not consider any nominee until after a new president is sworn in next January. He said Wednesday that Obama made this nomination with the intent of seeing this nominee confirmed, but in order to politicize it for purposes of the election.
The American people may well elect a president who decides to nominate Judge Garland for Senate consideration. The next president may also nominate somebody very different. Either way, our view is this: give the people a voice in filling this vacancy.
Senate Minority Leader Democrat Harry Reid of Nevada called on Senate Republicans to uphold their constitutional obligation to consider the president's nominee.
I hope that President Obama's nomination of an exceptionally qualified and consensus nominee will persuade Senate Republicans to change course. I do hope they will do their constitutional duty and give President Obama's nominee a meeting, a hearing, and a vote. He's doing his job this morning. The Republicans should do theirs from this point forward.
Legal analysts say that Garland will not excite Obama's progressive backers, but is a solid strategic choice given partisan divides in Washington. The nominee has been through this type of process before. When he was nominated for the appeals court in 1995, his nomination languished until after the 1996 election. Once former President Bill Clinton won re-election, Garland's nomination was confirmed by a 76-23 vote in 1997. Coming up, the U.S. Central Bank says it won't raise interest rates for now, And why are people in Denmark smiling? We'll find out. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The Obama administration is appealing to North Korea to pardon an American college student sentenced to 15 years of hard labor for committing crimes against the state. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said Wednesday that 21-year-old Otto Warmbier's punishment does not fit his crime of allegedly taking a banner with a political slogan from an area of his hotel that was off-limits to guests.
That the allegations for which this individual was arrested and imprisoned would not give rise to arrest or imprisonment in the United States or in just about any other country in the world. Now, despite official claims that U.S. citizens arrested in North Korea are not used for political purposes, it is increasingly clear that the North Korean government seeks to use these U.S. citizens as pawns to pursue a political agenda.
North Korean police arrested Warmbier as he was trying to leave the country after visiting with a tour group in January. A student at the University of Virginia, Warmbier appeared at a news conference in Pyongyang and admitted stealing the banner. As in all cases involving Westerners jailed in North Korea, Warmbier's confession likely was coerced and the alleged crimes exaggerated. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has told the Congress he needs more time to determine whether or not atrocities committed by the Islamic State constitute genocide. On Monday, Congress approved a measure to set a March 17th deadline for the administration to make a decision regarding atrocities committed by IS against religious and ethnic minorities in Iraq and Syria. However, Wednesday, State Department spokesman Mark Toner said because of the complexity of the charges, Mr. Kerry would not be done by the deadline.
Given the scope and the breadth of the analysis he's contemplating, he will not have a final decision completed by the congressionally mandated deadline tomorrow. However, this issue is clearly of the utmost importance to him, as well as Congress, and we expect him to reach a decision very soon.
The State Department spokesman said that while most people would acknowledge the Islamic State attacks against religious and ethnic minorities are appalling, meeting the legal status of genocide is a complicated and difficult process.
You know, determining these kinds of legal definitions, such as genocide and crimes against humanity, requires a very detailed, rigorous legal analysis.
The State Department said a final decision would not change the U.S. mission to degrade and destroy the Islamic State group. The last State Department designation of genocide was in 2004 by Secretary of State Colin Powell in response to murders and mass rapes in Sudan's Darfur region. The U.S. Central Bank's Policymaking Committee concluded 2 days of meetings in Washington Wednesday with an announcement to keep already low interest rates unchanged for now. Speaking to reporters, Federal Reserve Chairperson Janet Yellen said the U.S. economic outlook remains healthy despite the potential impact of weaker global growth. However, as Millar Sega reports, some analysts wonder why the Fed is being so cautious.
Despite persistently low energy prices and economic weakness abroad, Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen says the U.S. economy has been resilient in the face of shocks.
However, global economic and financial developments continue to pose risks. Against this backdrop, the committee judged it prudent to maintain the current policy stance at today's meeting.
Which means interest rates will remain unchanged at historic lows for now. The U.S. outlook remains largely unchanged since December, when the central bank raised rates for the first time in more than 6 years. But with a healthy job market and inflation inching closer to the Fed's 2% goal, some say the Fed missed an opportunity to normalize U.S. monetary policy. On Skype, Bankrate.com's chief financial analyst, Greg McBride.
When you look at the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, it is inconsistent with the current ultra-low level of interest rates that we have right now.
McBride says higher rates would have given the Fed more effective policy tools in the event of a sudden downturn. But speaking to VOA on Skype, economist Ryan Sweet at Moody's Analytics says raising rates too soon would have added to the turmoil in financial markets.
You know, the Fed really doesn't want to add additional volatility to equity markets and broader financial market conditions by increasing interest rates in March. I think the next likely time they'll move is June.
That's good news on Wall Street, where major indexes rose sharply on Wednesday. Investors and consumers have benefited from lower borrowing costs, which helped stimulate economic growth and employment during the recession. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
When you think of Denmark, perhaps you think of Shakespeare's brooding Prince Hamlet, dressed all in black and bent on revenging his father's death. Or maybe you think of the Vikings striking terror into Christian Europe as they swept across the continent. But happiness? Well, it turns out, according to the United Nations, the Danes are the happiest people in the world. In a study of 156 countries, the UN found the nation of 5.6 million people was the happiest on earth when it comes to things like people's health and access to health care, family relationships, job security, and social factors such as political freedom and degree of government. Kjartan Sverrestrup Ansbjerg is a researcher at the Happiness Research Institute in Denmark. He says that it's not about finding happiness in his country, but eliminating the things that make you unhappy.
The thing that really sets Denmark and the other very happy countries apart from other countries is not that we have a lot of very happy people, but just that we are able to eliminate extreme unhappiness.
Denmark has a high rate of volunteering, and many people enjoy physical activity, especially bicycling. The Cycling Without Age organization gets so-called pilots to pedal people around in classic Copenhagen Christiana cargo bikes. Kjartan Sverrestrup Ansbjerg says that in egalitarian Denmark, where 43% of the top jobs in the public sector are held by women, the pursuit of money and fame plays a very small role.
What we see from research on happiness is that we continuously, time after time, overestimate the value and the impact of wealth, of material riches.
Not everyone is happy in Denmark. Some people do complain that the country has very high taxes, but they have universal health care, and the state also pays for schools and universities. Students are given grants for up to 7 years. The second happiest country, according to the UN study, was Switzerland. Iceland, Norway, and Finland ranked third, fourth, and fifth. There's kind of a theme emerging there. The United States came in 13th. The unhappiest country in the world was Burundi. To see the full study, visit www.worldhappiness.report. Turning now to someone who seems to always have a smile on her face, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. Maybe the Twitterverse is a happy place to be. Hello, G.
Hi, Dave.
Now, is this report about happiness trending on Twitter?
I wouldn't say a lot of people are tweeting about it, but two very influential accounts are. The World Economic Forum and Bloomberg Business have both tweeted about it. The forum at WEF on Twitter wrote, "What one of the world's longest-running studies tells us about hashtag happiness." Bloomberg Business at Business wrote, "The World Happiness Report is out, and parents, you are miserable." That tweet got one reply. Tell me something I don't know.
Okay, well, from happiness, what else is trending on Twitter?
A lot of people are talking about President Obama's Supreme Court nomination. He made the announcement Wednesday, and the trending hashtag is hashtag SCOTUS nominee. For our international listeners, SCOTUS refers to the Supreme Court of the United States. But I want to stress that the nominee himself, Federal Judge Merrick Garland, isn't on Twitter.
Any stories trending outside of the United States?
One big international news is from the Vatican. Pope Francis reportedly fired the church's ambassador to the U.S., the one who arranged the Pope's meeting with Kim Davis last year. Davis is a county clerk in the state of Kentucky who became famous or infamous after refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples. That's all for me today. Dave?
That's VOA social media reporter G. Abby Lee. We'd like to hear what you have to think, including if you're happy or not. On Twitter, our handle is @VOA_IE. And some sad news from the music world. Singer, actor, and band leader Frank Sinatra Jr. has died. The Sinatra family said in a statement that Frank Jr. died unexpectedly of a cardiac arrest Wednesday while on tour in Daytona Beach, Florida. Kidnapped and held for ransom when he was 19, Frank Jr. had already followed his dad into the music business by then. He eventually worked for his father as his musical director and conductor. He performed the national anthem at a New York Yankees game last year. His older sister, Nancy, confirmed his death on Facebook, saying, "Sleep warm, Frankie." Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. You can find more on these stories on our website, voanews.com. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The strength of a nation depends on the success of all of its people. So any country hoping to grow and flourish must recognize the important contributions of women from all backgrounds and enable them to succeed in their work. Latin America has come a long way over the past two decades. Women serve in elected office, including as heads of state. They run businesses, large and small. They study and they teach. Yet they still face many obstacles. Perhaps most appalling is the widespread violence against women in the Americas, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. Noting that between 17% and 53% of all women in Latin America have been victims of physical or sexual violence inflicted by their partners, Undersecretary Sewell said that many Latin American countries rank among the worst in the world for the number of women killed each year. To prevent violence against women, we must address imbalances in education, employment, and politics that reinforce a culture where women are valued less than men, where they are somehow seen as less worthy of equal respect, opportunity, and protection. Women who have suffered violence must have a clear pathway to justice, a system that consistently enforces the law and ensures a fair and responsive judicial process. The U.S. government works to prevent and respond to violence against women, integrate a gender perspective into our work, especially to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. In 2012, the United States developed a global strategy to tackle all forms of gender-based violence, which affects all countries around the world, including the United States. In Latin America, we assist indigenous and African descendant women to participate in local government and advocate against violence and discrimination. We train women entrepreneurs to reach new markets, and we partner with local law enforcement to train more female police officers, prosecutors, and judges. We do this not only because gender equality is inherently worthwhile, said Undersecretary Sewell. When you broaden participation and emphasize inclusion, in business, in arts and culture, in politics, it enriches us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
is for, what's the universal